loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice. This week, we focus on the crucial new Supreme Court ruling against the practice of civil asset forfeiture. And then we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of outer space bring the world closer to a new catastrophe?
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today ruled out running for the Senate in the 2020 election. Speculation has been mounting that he would stand down from his role in the administration to campaign for the open seat in Kansas. But Pompeo insisted today that, quote, "I'm going to be the Secretary of State as long as President Trump gives me the opportunity to serve as America's senior diplomat." According to a court document released today, President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, will be sentenced on March 8th for bank and tax fraud. His sentencing on these charges will come just a few days before his scheduled sentencing for lobbying violations, which will be held on March 13th. Iran began military exercises in the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman today in a show of force designed to deter a possible U.S. attack on the country. A newly unveiled submarine capable of firing cruise missiles will take part in the drills for the first time. The war games comes just days after a U.S.-hosted conference in Poland aimed at building international support for regime change in Iran. U.S. officials today said that a key part of the upcoming Vietnam summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be developing a common understanding of what denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula means. The official said that the removal of U.S. troops from South Korea was not a subject of the discussion. The summit will take place next week in Vietnam on Wednesday and Thursday. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you for joining once again. Big decision yesterday from the Supreme Court. Paul Wright, let's start with you and talk about that.
Yeah, in a pretty amazing decision, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously yesterday that the Constitution's ban on excessive fines under the Eighth Amendment applies to state and local officials, and that they can't seize property in cases where people haven't been convicted of a crime. And the case came out of Indiana, where a gentleman named Tyson Timms sued the state after his land, a 42,000 Land Rover, was seized after he pleaded guilty to selling less than $400 worth of heroin. And the state took his money took his car, and he filed suit arguing that basically it was an excessive fine. And amazingly, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with them. And I think that part of the thing that we've seen is, and I think one of the reasons this is really important, is over the last 30 years, we've seen this massive abuse for basically police agencies, from local police to state police and federal agents, seize people's property, their money, with no evidence that it's connected to a crime. And oftentimes the police agencies are seizing property and money without even claiming that it's linked to a crime. And nationally, significant portions of police and prosecutor office budgets are composed of the money that they're seizing from citizens. And it's created even a weird situation where basically the government goes to seize assets and they say that it's up to the person whose money or property they're taking to prove that it isn't related to illegal activity. And I think that that's, which I think the notion of having to prove a negative is where that comes in. And of course, for a lot of people, you know, the amounts of money are relatively small, and either they don't have the money to hire an attorney, or the amounts of money at issue aren't enough to hire an attorney. And so, you know, those are all factors, I think, that have led to these massive abuses over the past, you know, that have led to these massive abuses over the past 30 years or so. So this is a pretty significant decision. I think one of the things that's also important is the fact that it was unanimous. All nine justices agreed that this is a problem and that it violates the Constitution. So I think this is probably, I think, one of the most significant criminal justice-related Supreme Court decisions in the past couple of years.
Paul, I think you're exactly right. And I do think the unanimous vote was really, really important. It's become, you know, a talking point, I think, for the left and the right, but especially in terms of criminal justice reform, the right has definitely been talking about this, because I think this is, for everyone, such a blatant, you know, civil asset forfeiture where police departments, law enforcement agencies are able to seize whatever they choose, you know, based on something, even something as small as speeding. They can seize your car, or they can seize money in your car. It's really, really a blatant exercise of power that is clear to see that it is not okay, and it is an abuse of power. It's an interesting extension, though. It seems like it's an extension of, you know, abuse of fines, excessive fines in probation and parole. When you get locked up, even, you also might have fines accrue. You are losing your liberty. That's a fine in some way, right? Also, this is a very blatant way that you see this excessive state power, but it's an extension of the state power mechanism in other ways, right? And so this, I think, is easy for people to get on board with, try to get this eradicated from our system. But Kevin, do you see this as an extension of these other pieces of state power as well?
I see it as a part of how governments like to fund themselves on the backs of poor and working class Americans, especially if they happen to be Latino or Black people, particularly, that you have these systems where you generate revenue, and that's through the fines and the imposing of penalties or the seizure of assets or property. And in this case, the Supreme Court's making it clear that it violates the Constitution, but that hadn't particularly stopped. I think that many states who have engaged in this practice have been on notice for at least 5 or 10 years, if not longer, that this practice was violating the Constitution, or that it was violating people's civil liberties. And there have been numerous cases brought individually in several states by organizations like the ACLU and maybe even other individual attorneys who have challenged the laws, smaller firms that have challenged the laws. And in fact, as a layman who's not a lawyer but just looks at this, it seems like one of the things that they always fell back on was that they were states and that they could make their own decisions, and that even if there was something federally that said that the federal government shouldn't get into this practice, and even if the federal government did to some extent, but there was challenge, and then I think it was backed off on a little bit because there was an uproar, especially when President Obama was in the White House, they still would say that, like, we could do this on our own as a state. We're allowed to make our own laws and decide how we want to handle this property. I think it's worth it to point out that in the opinion that was written, there's a connection made to how Southern states were enacting black codes. And it says in the decision, I'm just going to quote it here, that these black codes were to subjugate newly freed slaves and maintain the pre-war racial hierarchy. Among these laws, provisions were draconian fines for violating broad prescriptions on quote unquote vagrancy, end quote, and other dubious offenses. So I think you're right that to connect it back to some of these other ways of fining, you freed slaves were unable to pay these imposed fines. States would then turn around and demand involuntary labor from them instead. And there were congressional debates that were happening over these, but you know, in many cases, you saw people coerced into forced labor, or I guess you could just jail these individuals, and that's essentially probably what was happening if you wanted to look back at like Jim Crow laws.
That's Kevin Gostala. We're talking to Kevin and also Paul Wright in our weekly segment called Criminal Injustice. Paul Wright, let's stay with some of the points that Kevin just made, and of course, he's reading from the court decision itself, a 9-0. A unanimous ruling. The black codes really were the re-enslavement of newly freed African people in slave states, whereby the old slavocracy, once back in power, and that happened pretty quickly, was able to use another mechanism for enslaving people, which is arrest them, give them very, very high fines for even minor infractions. They couldn't pay the fines. And then the state actually leased the labor of the fined person, the indigent fined person, out to private landowners and plantation owners and farmers to be, you know, slaves again, once again. You know, we were discussing it here at our editorial meeting this morning. A lot of people don't know about the Black Codes and how this works. And then if you go forward to like what happened in Ferguson, we know about Michael Brown being killed by the cops, leaving his body in the streets for 4 hours. That triggered the Black Lives Matter movement. What more people don't know about is how the city of Ferguson used these same processes, these same methods, basically to fund the city government on the backs of the poorest, on the backs of the Black community. Anyway, go ahead.
And it's something that's still happening. And so I think that's one of the, you know, that's one of the things that even, you know, 4 years after the Ferguson uprisings and stuff like that, it's still an issue. And, but yes, this, you know, the use of the law, specifically, you know, Black Codes targeting people of color, that's been going on for literally since the end of the Civil War in 1865. But we've also seen an intensification, I think, across the board of this notion that basically getting people enmeshed in the criminal justice system and bleeding them dry for every penny they have or as much money as they have to literally pay for the police state on the backs of the policed, I think that's something that's really kind of gained momentum or currency in the past, you know, in the past, oh, I don't know, around the last 30 years or so. Starting, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s is when this started to really gain traction. And yeah, we've seen it just intensifying, and I think we see this to the point when significant portions of police and prosecutorial budgets come from this money. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, as soon as someone talks about, you know, reining in the police state or doing something about that, then the immediate response is, you know, well, you know, the money's got to come from somewhere. So then, if this doesn't come from, whether it's from seizures or fines or things like that, then we're going to have to raise taxes. And that's used as the boogeyman to try to squelch this type of efforts at reform. But, you know, but I think in a lot of respects, this I think goes back to, I think, you know, the disproportionate way that poor people fund the police state in this country. Whereas, you know, I think that, you know, if we need money for schools, no one is saying, well, let's go out and take the homes of the kids' parents to pay for the schools. If we say we need better roads or better infrastructure, no one says, well, let's seize the money from the bank accounts of people that live alongside the roadways or near the bridges. And yet somehow this has become an acceptable means of, you know, building up and sustaining the police state, is bleeding the people for money that become enmeshed in it. And ironically, of course, you know, and I think this gets us into a bigger discussion of, you know, who gets policed by the American police state, and it's primarily poor people. Like, this is in a case where, you know, rich people are having their assets seized, you know, or corporations that, you know, it's not a case where, you know, corporations that violate the law are having their assets forfeited or anything like that. It's largely individuals and generally the people that are, they have enough property to go after, but not enough resources to put up a good fight or a big fight. And that's what I think is one of the things that's also leading, naturally, I think it's also one of the things that's leading to a discrediting of the police state and the basis of civic government in this country, when police agencies are largely seen as basically modern-day pirates and robbers.
That's Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright and Kevin Gastala in our segment called Criminal Injustice, something that happens every Thursday here at Loud and Clear. Kevin, you're in the Midwest. You're in Chicago. I want to stay with the issue of Ferguson, an example again about how these excessive fines are used to have poor people basically fund the police state that then destroys them and their communities. I'm going to read a little bit from an NPR story in 2014. It was right after the killing of Michael Brown and the rebellion, the sustained rebellion of people in Ferguson. It was clear from the rebellion and from what came out afterwards that the killing of Michael Brown was a triggering event, but there were many other parts of what made people angry, other police violence, police misconduct. but also this issue of excessive fining. I want to read a couple sentences and then get you to react. To understand some of the distrust of police that has fueled protests in Ferguson, Missouri, consider this. In 2013, the municipal court in Ferguson, a city of 21,135 people, issued 32,975 arrest warrants for nonviolent offenses, mostly driving violations. Folks have the impression that this is a form of low-level harassment. That isn't about public safety. It's about money, according to Tom Harvey, one of the people, one of the members of an organization trying to do something about it. 32,975 arrest warrants in a city of 21,000 people. Go ahead.
What's important for people to know from what you're describing is, and we maybe have been hinting at it through our conversation, but I'll just say it explicitly, that these are people often who are not even accused of any specific crimes. And so while we're talking about the confiscation of property, if we could even have a discussion about that being legitimate, you would have to presume that those people were accused of criminal offenses. And in many cases, there aren't even any warrants for these individuals. They just are deemed to be engaged in behavior or conduct that has the hallmarks of a drug dealer or bears the hallmarks of what they think criminals would do. And so then they just take the property. I mean, we're talking about people who, I'm kind of going on a little bit of a tangent, but even here in Chicago, we've had an issue that I'm sure is not unique and has probably been experienced by people in Ferguson and other cities, where you have the police just take your cars. And you have them just confiscate your car, and this impounding of vehicles is done essentially because it helps the city balance its budget, or it helps different institutions pay for certain expenses that they have. And so, yes, what you're describing is a tremendous violation of people's rights. And let's also be clear here that between 2001 and 2014, this is according to the Washington Post, there was nearly $2.5 billion worth of collective assets seized by state and local police departments without any warrants. There's a lot of property. And if you're talking about taking a car from someone who relies on it to get to work, if you're talking about taking even tens of thousands of dollars from people who depend on that money to survive, you can imagine what that would mean for somebody who's struggling with poverty.
Paul, I want to go back to the case in particular, too, and make sure that it's clear to everyone what this case has actually done for people. So Tyson Timms, as you mentioned, is the Indiana resident whose luxury SUV, which was purchased near the time it was confiscated, it was purchased for about $42,000. That was confiscated because the police said that he'd used the car to transport drugs. However, $42,000 is about four times more than the maximum fine that the state could impose. So that was the way that they appealed, that Tyson Timms appealed this case. They said, well, the worth of this car is more than the state can impose a fine on, so you can't take this car. So the Indiana Supreme Court, as it made its way up, the Indiana Supreme Court said, well, the Constitution's ban on excessive fines doesn't apply to the states. It was never extended to the states, so you can't have that defense. The Supreme Court has now ruled, yes, it does apply to the states. So what does that mean for states and localities? What does that mean if somebody had their car confiscated last year? Does that mean they're able to appeal this? Are they able to get their car back? And then what does it mean tomorrow if a cop is driving down the street and tries to confiscate someone's property? Can they still do it? What are the limits on this? What does this mean?
I think that basically the law takes a long time. Not a long time. The law takes several years to catch up and for it to flush itself out. So I think it's going to be a while before we start seeing actual changes in practices. And I think this is going to be flushed out by the lower courts over the next couple of years. If you had your car taken last year, yeah, I think this is all the thing too, is you need to be consulting with lawyers knowledgeable in this area of law in your jurisdiction, because the law is going to vary from state to state. So that's going to be one of the things about talking to lawyers in your jurisdiction about whether or not you have any remedies for past for past seizures or past abuses of this. Going forward, how that's going to play out, I think, we're going to be seeing more litigation around this. And typically, unfortunately, what's happened, though, is I think that, what's really disgusting to me as a citizen and a taxpayer is the fact that the government comes in, they seize your assets and your property under these forfeiture laws, but then if you want to protect your assets and your property, you need to go out and hire a lawyer to do that. Well, they've got government lawyers paid for by, you got it, our tax dollars to argue for the seizure of your property. So it's a real, and all too often what happens is that a lot of people aren't able to afford counsel. And one of the ways that they've abused these forfeiture laws, in Mr. Tim's case, he was charged with a crime. What happens in a lot of these cases, though, is the government never charges anyone with a crime. So they don't have a right, if they're poor, they don't have a right to a government-appointed lawyer. So basically, the government will seize the property, seek to forfeit it, claiming it's the proceeds of illegal activity without ever charging the person with a crime. And then at that point, their only remedy to try to defend or protect their property is to go out and hire an attorney. And all too often, that's cost prohibitive, and people aren't able to do that. So and that's one of the things that I think has also led to a lot of these abuses in terms of how the situation has gotten as far out of control or out of hand as it's gotten now.
That's Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright and Kevin Gostala about the issues related to the criminal justice, or what we call the criminal injustice system. Again, I want to stay with this for another minute or so, or two even though time is going short, because it's such a big issue. Kevin, I'm looking at U.S. News and World Report about this ruling yesterday. Notably, the court's ruling stopped short of calling, quote, the basic validity of the practice into question or impose substantial limits, close quote. But it did put, quote, some high ceilings on state forfeiture of property, says this law professor who they quote. Then this next paragraph, and it's very important. Nonetheless, the ruling comes less than a week after President Donald Trump announced that he planned to draw some $600 million from civil asset forfeiture to fund new sections of the border wall. The money, about 8% of the project's cost, would come from the Treasury Department's forfeiture fund, which contains proceeds from federal investigations by the Treasury Department and the Department of Homeland Security. As a result, it would not be affected by the Supreme Court's ruling Wednesday, according to legal scholars. Quote, the decision simply applies existing constitutional limits on forfeitures to states. It does not articulate any new limits on forfeiture for the federal government, so it should have no effect on the proceeds President Trump is planning to use. Again, according to that same law professor. Kevin, go ahead.
Well, the key point to make here is that with all of the challenges to what the federal government has done when seizing property, when engaging in this asset forfeiture, there was a policy decision that was made by the Obama administration to take steps to move away from this practice. And then it was Donald Trump in 2017 who brought it back. And that was, of course, when Jeff Sessions was the head of the Justice Department. And so he fully is on board with that. And in fact, I believe that Donald Trump, I don't know that it's any easier than it was before Obama started to move, before the administration decided to move away from it a little bit. But he has set it up so that it is fairly easy for state and local law enforcement to transfer this property that is seized into the hands of federal government. So you can actually funnel the property, you can funnel what you have in assets to the federal government through programs or arrangements. And of course, you know that there is this setup that is in place where the federal government does give militarized equipment to local law enforcement agencies. There are ways that the federal government supports law enforcement through training and sending them other gear that isn't necessarily from the Pentagon. But it's very clear that Donald Trump believes that this practice is legitimate. And like you're saying, it doesn't, this ruling isn't going to stop them from continuing to have that arrangement. But I do think what is important to say is that having an unconstitutional ruling from the Supreme Court, like saying that there's a problem with this, is going to be huge for people who end up having their property seized unconstitutionally and against their rights. Because I believe that at least locally, people in those communities when you report it, I mean, you're going to have to say that this practice had been constrained or that the Supreme Court has come out against this practice. And it just seems to me that we're in a new era, that like having the Supreme Court make this ruling does change ever so slightly, but importantly, the way in which we view what is being done.
Kevin and Paul, we only have 3.5 minutes left. I want to go quickly to another story, and that is, it's a front page of your website, Kevin, how CNN led Facebook to censor pages of Russia-backed video company and manufactured news story. That's the In the Now, taken down by Facebook. Real quick, Kevin, why don't you tell us what this issue is, and then we'll get Paul to have a final comment.
Well, yeah, I can just quickly say that Facebook was led to censor these pages by CNN because a U.S. think tank called the German Marshall Fund flagged it. And what essentially they said is they believe that if you are a Russia-backed media organization, that you needed to be declaring that as such. They applied a standard that is not applied to all state-funded media. And they persuaded Facebook to basically announce that they might be doing something about state-funded pages. And so then they took down the In the Now pages, and they got rid of all of their videos. Of their pages were then censored and taken down. They had like somewhere around tens of millions of views to these videos. So, you know, all of that went away for the moment, and they're trying to get it back. But basically, there was nothing wrong. They weren't doing anything to violate policies, and this is very troubling for anyone who, you know, especially for us doing this show, is, you know, how easily it is for an organization to get CNN to justify censorship, and we don't know where it ends. We don't know how far it can go, and it was censored because it's expressing anti-U.S. Views, so to speak, or challenging corporations, and that's why. And you know, these videos might cover criminal justice issues. They might be very critical of mass incarceration in the U.S. So they were taken down. CNN targeted them.
Yeah, and Rania Kalik, who's a colleague on your podcast, also is a contributor to In the Now, a hard-hitting, independent, a progressive journalist. That's the impact of all of this, Paul, right? Taking down, censoring progressive voices in particular. We have 1 minute left.
I think this is all part of the ongoing effort to marginalize and further silence any voices that are critical of the police state or an imperialistic foreign policy and human rights violations carried out by, you know, by the U.S. government. And I think that, you know, as we've seen a proliferation of social media that goes beyond the legacy media and their role as gatekeepers of what is and isn't prudent political discussion in this country, we're seeing this is almost kind of like the backlash against that to shut down and silence anyone that's critical of the police state. So it's kind of a long continuum here. This is the latest manifestation of it.
That's Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Check out their media websites. Also, we were joined, as we are every week, by Kevin Gostala. We talked to Kevin from Chicago. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You're also joined by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the United States continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. Carl is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of the nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. And we're also joined by Bruce Gagnon. He joins us from Maine. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and he is also a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Carl, Bruce, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
I'm looking at some of the mainstream media coverage this week. I'm looking in particular right now at a Politico article. The title is Trump to approve lean Space Force. Again, this was the Space Force, the much talked about Space Force that Donald Trump wanted, but apparently it will be a division of the Air Force rather than its own new branch of service. Anyway, does that have any significance, Bruce Gagnon?
I don't think so. I think the clear thing here is that the U.S. is pushing forward. Space has long been militarized with military satellites, and now they're moving to space weaponization, which is really the most dangerous aspect of all. So the name of it isn't really that important. There's been a Space Command for many, many years within the Air Force, and this is really just changing the name of the Space Command to the Space Force. But the real issue is the weaponization.
Bruce, what are some of those weapons? I mean, what can the United States or other powers put up into space that can have such devastating consequences here on Earth?
Well, one thing they're talking about now is space-based missile defense. So missile defense is a misnomer. It's really a key part of U.S. first strike attack planning. The idea is the U.S. launches a attack to take out Russian and Chinese nuclear forces on the ground and under the ocean in their submarines. And following that, Russia and China then try to fire a retaliatory strike with their remaining capability. It is then that the so-called missile defense shield is used to pick them off, giving the U.S. a successful first strike attack. This is something that the Space Command has annually been wargaming for many, many years. They call it the red team versus the blue team. So now they're talking about putting missile defense systems that currently are on land and on Navy Aegis destroyers, interceptor missiles on those. They're now talking about putting interceptors in space. They would give them a whole new level of technology. They're also working on systems that can fire from space and hit targets on the Earth below. Some of these systems are called rods from God. Other ones have actually been tested when they did a mission to the moon some years ago and proved that an orbiting space vehicle could fire and actually send a missile into the moon beneath the surface of the moon, so it would be part of first strike attack. So it's many, many different technologies are being worked on at the same time.
That's the voice of Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He's also a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. We're also joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. Carl is the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Carl Grossman, a rod from God. I mean, clever, but also sort of playing with danger here. Maybe more dangerous than what we anticipate from God. Go ahead.
God wouldn't like this idea at all. We're talking here about turning the heavens into a war zone, and that notion of rods from God, and they have this whole plan of these rods hurtling down from space, from battle platforms in space to targets on Earth. And just what Bruce is talking about, the weaponization of space, and what Trump did this week along those lines was to sign something called a Space Policy Directive 4. Space Policy Directive 4. And I'm just reading here from the White House press release, a bold strategic step towards guaranteeing American space dominance. Catch that word, dominance. And I mean, this has been going on for months. Indeed, back last year, Trump, in first advancing his notion for a space force, a separate branch of the armed services, the Marines and the Navy, and this would be a separate space force. And what Trump said then was, it's not enough to merely have American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space. And just one last but important thing here, because of resistance so far in the House of Representatives to a separate space force, what Trump in this directive has set up would be a space command within the established military. But what also is part of Space Directive 4 would be the groundwork for a separate space force. And in fact, that political article talks about, they quote some insider in the Trump administration saying that this would be advanced in the, God help us, speaking of God, the second Trump administration.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, Bruce. Let's assume Donald Trump wins re-election, which is certainly a possibility. This is, and it seems to me that Trump, because he's Trump, he hasn't started something new, but he's fast tracking something. He's taking great pride in it. He wants to be the man. He wants to have his own signature attached to it. Do you agree that this, in terms of what comes next under Trump with what Carl Grossman was speculating?
Yeah, that seems to be the clear agenda. I think they got a lot of pushback. There's a lot of support for the Air Force, particularly in the Senate, from what I've been reading, and that it was the people in the Senate that said, forget about the Space Force for now, we'll just put it under the Air Force, under the existing Space Command. But I think the weapons industry, the aerospace industry, really wants this bad because they know that if they can get a separate Space Force online and funded, it's massive, massive profits. You know, they've been saying at the Pentagon for many, many years that Star Wars would be the largest industrial project in human history, necessitating a separate funding source. And some years ago, in one of the industry publications called Space News, they said, we've come up with a dedicated funding source for this, and we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. And they said it's the entitlement programs that officially are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program, the safety net.
Let's just restate that, Bruce. Who said that?
Space News, in one of the industry publications, in an editorial some years ago, they said, we know how to pay for all this stuff. Cut the entitlement programs, move the money into these space programs.
Well, that should be a great relief for all the people who can't take their kids to a doctor to know that the United States will gain a dominance in space, or certainly trying to. Again, it seems like this should be an issue around which a lot of people should be able to be mobilized, because it will be an enormous cost. It will be an ongoing cost. It'll be a form of welfare for military contractors. What's the possibility for opposition here? Obviously, it's not coming from inside the halls of Congress, except sort of on a long bureaucratic line. Should it be in the Air Force or not?
Well, you know, the House of Representatives can stop this thing cold. And now that they are ostensibly under the control of the Democrats in the House, you think there would be a chance. But unfortunately, so many Democrats are slaves to the military-industrial complex. But I think the American people, they really need to see that if they fight for Social Security, if they fight for Medicare and Medicaid, they can help stop this new arms race in space, this most expensive arms race in the history of the planet.
Professor Grossman, I mean, in addition to, you know, there never being enough money for meeting people's needs, whether that's in the form of, you know, adequate healthcare services, education, housing, a decent retirement, there also never seems to be enough money, according to the politicians, for, you know, peaceful scientific exploration and scientific discovery. Talk about, you know, the civilian space budget. How has NASA, how has, you know, the actually beneficial things we can do in space been downgraded over the years in relation to the amount that's being dedicated to the military-industrial complex?
Well, because of fears of budget cuts, and I mean, look at NASA now, so much of what NASA had been doing has become privatized. NASA, married with the Pentagon. This is years ago. It was set up, NASA in 58, as a civilian agency. This is a year after Sputnik was launched. But it quickly understood that where the money is in Washington is in the Pentagon. So it began doing what were called dual missions with the military. I mean, many of those shuttle missions were military missions that were seven colonels aboard. And when they came back, nobody was talking as to what was what had occurred. NASA is a skeleton of what it was. And where the big money is, and this has been going on for years, has been in space military operations. But as Bruce notes, one thing is to have the militarization of space, which is abhorrent in many ways, satellites and so forth, to reconnaissance and so forth. But what's occurring here is a headlong dash to weaponize space. I mean, just let me go on with that White House, and you can get it online. That's where I got it, with the White House statement, leading in a new warfighting domain. President Trump knows warfare is changing. Space is now a warfighting domain, just like the air, land, and sea. But it ain't supposed to be that way. There's something called the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which was put together by the United States, Russia, then the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. And it's been signed on, nearly 200 countries around the world, including the United States, have signed on to the Outer Space Treaty, which sets up space as a global commons for peaceful purposes, not for making war. And there's all kind of prohibitions, like weapons of mass destruction, like rods of God, shouldn't be up there in space as weapons. So we have the framework to keep space for peace, but when this White House statement talks about Trump knows warfare is changing and space is now a warfighting domain, the person and the administration which would make it a warfighting domain is Trump and his scoundrels in Washington.
So, Bruce Gagnon, let's turn to you. I mean, Professor Grossman was talking about the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. I mean, 1967, that was, you know, in some ways the height of the Cold War. Why now, when, you know, the Cold War is supposedly over? I mean, why now is the militarization of space going ahead at such a breakneck pace?
Well, you know, it was during the Bush administration, Bush 2, George W., one night I was watching C-SPAN, and Thomas Barnett, then an instructor of the Naval War College in Rhode Island, author of a book called The Pentagon's New Map, made a three-hour presentation that I took copious notes. One thing he said was that the U.S. was no longer going to do international treaties. We're going to walk away from them because they would restrict our ability to control the planet on behalf of corporate interests. And that's why we see the U.S. during that Bush administration pulled out of the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and now Trump has just recently pulled us out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. It's very clear that the United States is looking over its shoulder, seeing the rise of a multipolar world where Russia and China and India, Brazil, South Africa, many countries, Iran, are becoming powerful, and the United States doesn't like that and wants to stay in control of everything, militarily and economically, something that can't happen. It's just, you know, it's a rising tide here is going to flood those dreams of U.S. domination. But so they view space as an opportunity. If they can control and dominate space, then they can see everything on the planet, target everything on the planet, intercept all communications on the planet, and deny other countries the use of space as well. So it's very provocative, very dangerous moment, but they're going for it. They because they sense that if they don't do it now, their day as the empire is over.
Yeah, Professor Grossman, this could set off a arms race, a global arms race in space. Talk a little bit about that possibility. What danger does this pose in terms of, you know, the message it sends to other powers with the ability to put weapons into space, nuclear or otherwise?
It definitely will trigger a massive and incredibly, unbelievably expensive arms race in space, because Russia and China, they're not going to accept American dominance of the planet from space. And I mean, this is what this is all about, as Bruce outlines. And as reluctant as they've been, in fact, China and Russia and our neighbor Canada have been in the forefront in advancing what's called a Paros Treaty, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space Treaty, which would preclude not only weapons of mass destruction in space, but all weapons in space. And the United States has fought that through administration after administration. And I've been to Russia several times. I've been to China. And I've spoken to their people, including, I remember sitting at a table with Chinese diplomats in Moscow, speaking to folks there in high positions. They do not want to waste their national treasuries on an arms race in space. Remember those young Chinese diplomats saying how we want to educate, we want to house, we want to provide health care for our people. We don't want to blow it on war in space. But if the United States moves up into space with the intent to dominate the Earth below from space and dominate space as well, like any nation could dominate space, China's going to be up there. Russia's going to be up there, and that's just the beginning of an arms race in space. Watch India, watch Pakistan, and so forth. In terms of human history, it's going to be such a waste. The word waste doesn't describe it. And once it happens, once there is an arms race, once there are battle platforms up in space, preparations for war in space, inevitably, there'll be war in space, and there'll be no going back.
That's the voice of Professor Carl Grossman. We're joined by Carl Grossman and Bruce Gagnon on this new segment where we talk about the militarization of outer space. It's happening with dynamism. It's real. It's going to change. It's going to change everything, in fact, unless it's stopped, unless the people do something to stop this. Bruce, I'm looking at the, I'm just sort of researching as we're talking about the Outer Space Treaty. And the question asked is, why was the Outer Space Treaty created? No weapons of mass destruction in orbit. In 1967, when the Outer Space Treaty was signed, the Cold War was in full swing. Both the U.S. and the Soviet Union wanted to prevent the expansion of the nuclear arms race into a completely new territory. I want to talk about that because, one, it would seem to me that the treaties that were being signed for land-based nuclear weapons were premised on the understanding from both the Soviet leadership and the American government that neither side could really achieve supremacy, that there was an equilibrium that had been achieved, and that equilibrium was an equilibrium based on terror, mutually assured destruction. If a war started, both sides would perish, and they wanted to prevent other countries who were not the Soviet Union and not the United States from also going forward and acquiring nuclear weapons that might threaten them or threaten others. So there was a logic to arms treaties. And then you could extend that same concept, that same equilibrium to outer space. Now, I then looked at another, I just asked another question. Is it legal to have weapons in space? Because if they're banned from space, you would think putting them in space would then be illegal, at least based on this international treaty. And here's what the answer is when you bring it up. And this is from a website, UCS USA. While Article 4 bans weapons of mass destruction from orbit, it does not prohibit missile-borne weapons of mass destruction from transiting space or weapons other than weapons of mass destruction being placed in space orbit and used to attack targets in space or on Earth. There is no ban on air, ground, or conventional space-based anti-satellite or anti-missile weapons. What's your reaction to that, Bruce?
Yeah, that's my understanding. I'll tell you a story to illustrate this point. Some years ago, I was reading an account of the Space Command's annual war game, first strike attack on Russia and China. At that time, they were working on the thing called the space-based laser, what they called the Death Star at the Pentagon, and it was powered with nuclear reactors. And so this laser was going to fire and knock out other country's satellites and also point down to the Earth and hit targets on the Earth below. And in the war game, they had the Space Command people were sitting at a computer, and next to them was a lawyer, a military lawyer. And they turned to the lawyer and they said, can we use the space-based laser? And, or would it violate the 1967 Outer Space Treaty that banned weapons of mass destruction in space? And the lawyer said, no, it doesn't violate it because it's a weapon of selective destruction and therefore falls outside of that treaty. And that's the reason for the last 20-some years that Russia and China have gone to the United Nations saying, look, let's close the door to the barn before the horse gets out. Let's create a new treaty, a broader treaty that covers all these technologies. But the United States and Israel have been blocking that treaty for years. It's gone nowhere because of U.S. blocking it. And the U.S. official position through Republican and Democrat administrations has been, hey, there's no problem. There are no weapons in space. We don't need a new treaty.
What you're saying then is it's not simply Trump. I mean, in other words, the Russians and the Chinese have been going to the U.N. and saying, let's close this door, the gap. Make sure that it's, you know, you don't drive a tractor through it or a space-based weapon through it. And the U.S. has been saying no. So the issue isn't really Trump, even though Trump seems to be, you know, wanting to take credit for this new advance.
both parties have been supporting this space domination program, and it's because both parties believe in this idea of U.S. exceptionalism, that we are the God's chosen people. We should be in charge of the world because we're the good guys, that's very dangerous. That's why now with a Democrat-controlled House of Representatives, it's going to be interesting to see how they go on Trump's Space Force proposal. They have to fund it. And so I urge every listener to be getting in touch with your member of the House of Representatives and telling them, no, don't support this, because that money's going to come out of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the social safety net. We can't afford it.
Carl, you know, I'm looking at Bruce's website here, and everybody can go check it out. It's space4peace.blogspot.com, because he's republished some excerpts from Donald Trump's executive order, and it goes to some of those themes that Bruce was just speaking about. I want to read a couple of these excerpts and then get your reaction to it. So this is under the subheading of Vital National Interest. Space is a key source of strategic advantage for the United States, and potential foreign adversaries are determined to restrict our access to it. America has the most capable military in the world, but we must address the looming threats from foreign adversaries in space to maintain our leadership and outpace competitors. America will always seek peace through strength, and we will work with our allies and partners to secure that peace in space. Pretty remarkable, the language that's being used there. What's your reaction?
Well, you know, one thing they also say in that, this is the announcement that you're reading from by the Trump administration just days ago, and they blame that their adversaries, saying, essentially trying to make the point that they're now leading this arms race. They're getting ahead of us. That's always been this thing the U.S. Weapons war machine always comes out with. Oh, everybody else is getting ahead of us. We've got to catch up. But it's a total lie. Russia and China are not leading this whatsoever. The U.S. has been leading this space arms race from the very beginning, ever since the Nazis were brought over here after the end of World War II in Operation Paperclip to create the U.S. space program. Wernher von Braun, Major General Walter Dornberger. And in fact, Dornberger, who was Hitler's liaison between Hitler's office and the rocket scientist Wernher von Braun and his engineers, 100 of them were brought over here along with copies of the V-2 rocket after the war was over. Dornberger became vice president of Bell Aerospace in New York, and he testified before the Congress of the United States, giving the vision of orbiting battle stations. So what Trump is now laying out today is actually the Nazi prophecy articulated in the Congress of the United States, come home to roost. I mean, it's, you know, and I've always asked the question, when you bring over 1,500 of the top Nazi operatives after World War II in Operation Paperclip and seed the military-industrial complex with them, the CIA, space medicine, you know, the space, create the space program, all that stuff, is there an ideological contamination that comes along with them? And I think the answer is clear.
Carl Grossman, is Bruce being hyperbolic? I mean, this is a Nazi fantasy coming true?
No, it's terrible reality. Just like Bruce relates, we brought over under Project Paperclip after World War II these Nazi scientists. He talks about Wernher von Braun, Dornberger, and all these characters, and they formed bit of the core of the American space military program. And now with Trump, we see, I mean, under Reagan, we had that program to happen with Star Wars, but now with Trump, I even think it's a bigger push than during the Reagan time. It has to be stopped. And in terms of how to stop it, just let me suggest, first of all, folks should go to that website of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, because it's been the global network, the grassroots organization challenging this, and they need your help. And the URL there is space 4, like you mentioned, 4, numeral 4, space4peace.org. And see all the things that the global network has been doing since 1992, including having every year a Space for Peace Week. So that's been the leading grassroots organization challenging this madness. And just in terms of, if I can, I can mention the attitude of other countries. And I discussed before how Canada has been a lead. Our neighbor Canada has been in the lead trying to get this Paris Treaty voted in, along with Russia and along with China and so many other countries. And here, just a quote from a Chinese official this week regard to Trump's action. I want to make it clear that outer space belongs to all mankind. It is not exclusively owned by any one country, and especially not the private property of the U.S.
Very interesting points. And just to reiterate that website, it's space4peace.blogspot.com.
That's all the time we have. We were joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program on these topics. We were joined also by Bruce Gagnon. He talked to us from Maine. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.